But as I read about how the breakup happened, I immediately flash to, I'm guessing about 9 years or so later, when the Duncan Levertov friendship explodes.
Yeah.
She has the temerity to not be his student anymore. I don't know however you want to put that, but you know, in both cases, despite his standing up for poetics or whatever, Duncan comes across as an asshole.
Yeah, see, that's the thing. He stood on his poetics. I think he's consistent with that. But at the same time, he wasn't kind. You know, I mean, Robin had been an acolyte for many years, and he openly deferential. He openly gave credit to Duncan, and then when you slap somebody down like that by saying, "Okay, I'm going to retranslate those poems correctly," right? That's a real slap in the face. And he published everything in the poetry audit issue in 1967. That's like making it all public. Huh? So that was a public. It was a public put down. It was like down in your place.
Right, rubbing his face in it.
Yeah, and I think with Levertov, it sounds to me something similar. You know, you don't. I don't think that your political poems are very interesting as poems, and I don't think that's what poetry is about. There was a difference there.
Rhetoric.
Yes. Yeah, and they split over it. So he could be. I don't think Duncan was kind in that way, and I don't pretend to read the psychology or the personality. I'm not there. I'm not, you know, I didn't know Duncan personally, although I did meet him when he came up to Vancouver once. I suspect that maybe from his point of view, it wasn't so much that he thought he personally was being unkind, he thought he was defending a poetic position. But there was no recognition of the you know, friendships that were being also handled in that situation, I think. Right. It was cruel to do. I mean, you could disagree with somebody poetically and stand on your ground and say, "I don't think your translations do justice to Nerval," say, you know. But to republish and then sort of openly, you know, put the results in a magazine seems to be fairly cruel.
It's a big fuck you.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm going to inject my own rhetoric here. But Blazer, as a poet, he peaks in his 80s. And Duncan, as a poet, has those three books, Opening of the Field.
Yeah.
Of Bending the Bow and Roots and Branches, mm-hmm. and then he tops out.
Well, he has Groundwork 1 and 2.
Yes, but I don't think it's as good as those three books. I think he peaks with those three. And it's interesting that when he and Levertov are having their correspondence, their work is as good as it was going to get. And after the split, neither of them were writing the same quality work, I think, as before, which is interesting. So in terms of, now I'm looking this, here's me injecting myself into this, and I hate to do this, but I'm looking at these as models for poetry, and the Blazer model, peaking in your 80s, seems a lot more attractive. It seems to me the way to go. You know, I just had tea at Michael McClure's house, and he's 87, and he's got a manuscript, Mule Kick Blues, and it's as good as any of the stuff he's ever written in his life. To me, that... when you can peak in your 80s as a poet, that's saying something.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I'm not... I don't feel really qualified to evaluate Duncan's work and as, you know, whether it's good, bad, indifferent, that sort of thing, whether, you know, in terms of the periods. But I do think he had a very definite point of view. I think he was prepared to defend it. I think that for those he felt were his juniors in poetry, he did not well tolerate insubordination. Let's say that. I don't think he did. Yeah.
So Blazer at this time is really getting a sense of the serial.
Yes.
And a narrative of the spirit. mm-hmm. is what he would call it.
Yes, yes,
so
he did
call it when he sits down, he's not sitting down to write a poem, and Jack Spicer drilled into his head, there's no such thing as the single poem.
Yes.
So this, the roots of the serial are there, and mm-hmm. And then he writes several serial poems at this time, doesn't publish them or as chapbooks,
mm-hmm.
and then says something like every serial, well, it says this in the book, a quote from the book, page 122, every serial reworks and modifies the poems that precede it so that the scope and meaning of the whole evolves in difference through repetition.
That's my take on what he does with the serial, you know, that your past is rolled in to the present. It always is going to be that way. And so I think that, you know, I discovered this when I was trying to write about the first Holy Forest. But when you get all the way to the end of, say, Pell Mell, right, which is a fairly late-ish work, it's 80s, and you look at Cups, you think, well, the seed was there in Cups, you know? But you can't see that until you get all the way through to Pell Mell or maybe Exidy or something, some of the later pieces. And then you see, oh, the plot is in Cups. It's in the first serial. Mm-hmm. Or even earlier, Hunger of Sound. And he's just been writing that poem. But unless, if he'd only written that poem, you would never be able to see that, ever.
Right.
So it's like, it's an evolution, difference in repetition, all the way through. So you get the traversal of this territory, you know, whatever it happened. In Cups, it's a kind of combination of the, in my reading of it anyway, the big narratives of Western Civ and his own biographical beginnings in Idaho,
mm-hmm.
and how those are woven together. Those are woven together throughout, right? As I read it, those narratives are the big narratives of the ghosts of the poems, you know, they're the big story of the Holy Grail and the mm-hmm. story of the creation of the universe, the big mythic cosmic stories are there, but they're there as ghosts. And
Or as seedlings.
As how do you go from there? Because the narratives, those narratives, as they were presented as sort of absolutely literal renditions of cosmic order, have fallen out of belief. And when something falls out of belief, it becomes a ghost in language,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So then it's not as if the relationships that those narratives were meant to pull together have disappeared, or they're not still part of human potentiality, but you've got to find them again.
Mm-hmm.
And so then you have to, so in that sense, they are seeds,
right.
And you need to keep things moving forward. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So to traverse that over and over again, you mm-hmm. find that kind of ghostly quality, and I think in a lot of Blazer poems all the way through.
And then there's an allusion, or I'm reminded of Jack Spicer play on logos, the word logos, mm-hmm. with low ghost,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Which Mackey then, in his serial, which is long after the period we're talking about, has lay ghost, which is an allusion to Lagos, Nigeria.
Is it, you mean Papa Lava, the
Nate, Haitian? Nate Mackey, kind of playing off the Duncan
right.
and Spicer
yeah.
with Lagos instead of Logos,
uh-huh.
and Lagos, Nigeria. There's a notion of this serial reworking and modifying the poems, and that is a notion of William Carlos Williams that I was reminded of by Barry McKinnon,
mm-hmm.
who said that Williams believed that each, and I can't find the source in Williams, but each poem that you write should be a summation of your life up until that point. So that's consistent mm. with this seriality.
Yeah. Yes, I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. And with the idea that the end of the story is not within your grasp.
Right.
In fact, nobody writes the end of their own story because they can't actually write their death.
Yeah. Right.
So you have to, you just have to go with it as far as you can go. It's that too. I mean, for Spicer, Robin talked about that as Spicer's line between the, you know, the mystics, St. John of the Cross. That is, it's a discipline, a practice of not knowing where you need to go.
Agnosia.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Is a serial poem the most open form in poetry?
Oh golly, I don't know. I don't think I'm that smart. I don't know. I mean, I have seen some concrete poems, some sound poems that are really, I wouldn't know how to describe them, except as, you know, open to just about any possibility. So certainly, when you look at a Blazer poem alongside that, and you think, you know. I mean, I'm thinking, for example, of poems, the Four Horsemen did some of them. They're just, that just give the vowels. And A-E-I-O-U. This is back in the 80s, where...
With a scream as the chorus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so what they're doing, I mean, in the vowels are all possibilities. It's a passage of air through the throat, so all words potentially are there. That's about, I don't know if you can operate in language and get more open than that. And so certainly Robin has a lot more, there's a lot more, you know, close syntactic strings in his work. He's got a lot more structure than that. Right. Yeah. So
the answer is no.
But in terms of performing, I mean, in some ways, depends how you understand open. Mm-hmm. In terms of performing a space, I think that's a gate. I keep coming back to the word performance because it is a theatrical act. I perform this space of assembly. I'm not sure that a poem that gives you the vowels, unless you say that all of humanity is there in the assembly, and maybe that's what the poem says.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not a really workable idea of a particular space,
right,
because it's not particular.
Right.
But for the performance of an open space, that this is the voices that come in, you know, and it's going to be different for you than it is for me because your context is different. That's the theater piece. I think that those poems act out over and over and over again.